They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Shu Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights.
On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Shu Bartholomew. Joining me today on the Commons is my old friend Tom DeWeese. And Tom is the founder and president of the American Policy Center right here in Virginia. He has been shaking the world up a lot, and he has been making some waves. And I like people who make waves, especially when I can call them my friend. Tom, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, Shu. Always glad to be with you.
I know you've been very busy, and I know you've been doing a whole lot of shows lately, and you've been always writing a lot of articles. And before we go any further, why don't you give us your website so that people can go and read this stuff?
Sure, yeah. We're American Policy Center, and the website is americanpolicy.org, and we've got about a 15-year or better archive on there of articles I've written over that time on a lot of different issues. And also we have focused on trying to put together tools that activists can use to help them in their local fights. You can get them there.
So make sure you check it out. But today we're going to focus on something that's near and dear to both of our hearts. So you wrote an article, Tom, The 5 Actions Ben Carson Must Take to Control HUD's Tyranny. And I want you to tell us a little bit about it. But first, any idea if and when he's ever going to get confirmed?
I don't know. The Democrats are doing everything they can to drag their feet. And I just heard this morning, as a matter of fact, that they are planning to not confirm any more of Trump's people. They're going to do everything they can to stop him from getting his full cabinet in place. So in other committees, the Republicans got smart, and they went ahead and did it anyway. And the heck with it, whether the Democrats were there. So maybe they'll do that, you know, in the rest of these. But it's interesting to see that, you know, them standing up against Ben Carson. Of all the people who have been nominated for positions and agencies and so forth, Ben Carson is one man who actually lived under the rules and regulations, lived in the atmosphere of public housing and so forth that HUD oversees. So who would know better what the shortcomings are and what to do about it? But some reason they don't want him to be there.
I don't know either. I'm having a little hard time understanding, other than being obstructionist, because there's some good people that have been nominated, and we need to move forward. I mean, if you look at Betsy DeVos, everybody's all upset. Oh, my God, you can't have her there. She's privileged, and she's this, that, and the other. Tom, we're number 30 worldwide.
Yeah.
Do
well,
we
the,
want to come out of that?
Education system is absolutely abominable, and I really wish that Donald Trump would have taken the position to get rid of the Department of Education altogether. Ronald Reagan promised it, and when George H.W. Bush got in there with him as vice president and got his own cronies in there, they stopped him from doing that. It has now come into place and has just absolutely destroyed our education system. We have 50 departments of education across the country that are state departments, and we got local school boards, all of that, and you know, that's perfectly fine to put together a good education system. We don't need a federal Department of Education, but there it is. But I also believe the same thing is true about the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I really believe it has no purpose in life, and it should be abolished as well. There's nothing in the Constitution that says anything about education or housing and urban development. But unfortunately, putting these people in these places, so we have to deal with what we get.
It would seem to me that they would want someone who's got some knowledge, not someone who, God only knows what, has paid enough money into their coffers. I don't know how that works, but I don't think it's very fair or above board.
Maybe the problem is they don't want somebody in there who knows what it's all about, because like so many other things in our government, the propaganda, the doublespeak, the hidden stuff, certainly is dealing with, you know, that's the situation with HUD. It is sold as the agency to help the poor, to get fair housing, to get a fair shake. They tie it to the civil rights movement and the civil rights legislation from 1964 and on and on and on. And so, you know, the idea is if HUD were to be abolished, or if the wrong person gets in charge of that, then minorities in the country, the poor and so forth, would be disadvantaged again, and they'd be back on the plantation and on and on and on, all the usual rhetoric. You know, it's interesting, as you watch what HUD is doing, that is exactly what it's doing now. It is diminishing people. It is creating a situation where they are, they have no say, they have no way out, and we are creating more and more ghettos, and we're creating more and more poor because of these federal agencies that are supposedly there to take care of that. So, it's interesting how the doublespeak turns out and what the reality really is.
So I've been told, and I've heard from so many people, and I also believe it, that the road to personal wealth is through property ownership. It's not everybody's going to win the lottery. Not everybody's going to win millions of dollars. For the average person, doesn't it make more sense to own property?
Well, this was the reason why the United States, from the beginning, that our main tenet of how we operated and so forth was ownership of private property. And we became one of the wealthiest nations on earth almost overnight. I'm holding in my hand a book by a gentleman named Hernando de Soto. He is a Peruvian economist. I just missed an opportunity to meet with him a couple weeks ago, but he wrote a book called The Mystery of Capital: Why Capitalism Triumphs in the West and Fails Everywhere Else. And basically, and the Times of London called this the blueprint for a new industrial revolution, this book. The premise of what Hernando de Soto goes around the world speaking on is that private property ownership is the main means to building individual wealth. And the reason that we have teeming poverty and the horrible conditions around most of the world is because in most countries of the world, private property is not allowed because they're run by dictators who are controlling what's going on. And the real difference in the United States and just a few other Western countries is that every single bit of property in our country is registered. We know we own it. There's proof to show we own it. Once that's done, then a property owner can use that property to get loans. They can build equity in that. 60% of the businesses in this country were started by people using the equity in their private property to finance the business. And that ended up with 60% of the American people working for such companies. Now, I don't know if that's true today, but that was in the past. And this is how we created a middle class. Hernando de Soto told me that when I met with him a couple of years ago, that he, when he travels around the world, he meets with these world leaders, and you know, leaders of various countries, and they will start to tell him, well, our people aren't ready for that yet. They don't understand property rights ownership. And he told me that one day he knew he was going to get one of these kind of meetings. And so he sent a team around the presidential palace before the meeting and had people knocking on doors saying, excuse me, do you own this house? This was in a country where private property rights and ownership weren't allowed. And every one of them said, yes. And they asked them for some kind of proof. Some of them had wills. Some of them had receipts, various things like that. They made copies of all this, and Hernando took it with him into the meeting, put it on the table in front of him, said, let's get this out of the way right now. Your people are ready. They understand property rights. You're the one in the way.
Wow.
So, and another, let me just add one more thing to that, because this is vital to what we're talking about. In 2006, I was invited to Cambridge University in England to debate the issue of the United Nations before a 200-year-old debating society, the Cambridge Union. And one of the people I was debating was a gentleman named Salih Shetty. He was, at that time, the head of the UN's Millennium Project. Millennium Project, one of its main points, it had 8 goals at that time. They've now expanded that with Agenda 2030 to 17 goals, same thing. But the main goal was that they were going to eliminate poverty by the year 2015. And, of course, the only answers that the UN has for this is redistribution of wealth. We're going to eliminate poverty by taking from these guys and giving to these guys. And the result has been more poor. You know, it's a growth industry. I'm sitting next to Salih Shetty at a formal dinner before we're ready to go in and debate. And right just before we were ready to leave, I turned to him and I said, you realize you don't have a prayer, don't you? And he looked at me and he said, about what? And I said, eliminating poverty by the year 2015. He said, yeah, I know. And then I started quoting Hernando de Soto. I didn't say his name, but I started talking about private property ownership as the route to building wealth. He looked at me and he said, Hernando de Soto. And I said, yes. And he said, I have colleagues who are looking upon his things favorably, his ideas. Then they called us to debate. We go in, we have the debate. As soon as it was over, I ran across the room to him and I said, Mr. Shetty, you and I started a conversation and I want to finish it. We ended up in his office at the United Nations a few weeks later, and we started talking about this. He was Indian, from India, and he started to tell me how in his village or his city that he was from in India, they had started to register private property and the economy was starting to rise. Boom. Mic drop.
There you go.
So, yeah.
There you go. Yeah. Well, I think, there's so much pride and sense of accomplishment and all kinds of good stuff that comes when you've actually bought something and you own something. But even though in this country we seem to think that it's okay, we have private property rights and, you know, we have private property and we register them and we have deeds and we have all the other wonderful stuff, but we have so many other things that just hinder your use of using it, your ability to use it the way you pretty much want to use it?
Well, we have come to a point in this country where people really don't even know what private property is because it has been so invaded, so ruled and regulated.
Yes.
It used to be you could put a no trespassing sign up and you could say, step across that line and suffer the consequences. This is my property. My home is my castle. All these kind of things we used to say about private property. It was very well understood. This is mine and I can do what I want to do in it and you can't tell me what else to do. Now, when we talk about that and say things like that, then the other, you know, these people who are trying to control all this get very agitated and very upset. And you use the words unrestricted to my property, and they just go ballistic. And what they always do is they start screaming bloody murder that, oh my gosh, if you have unrestricted right of use of your property, then somebody might build a stinky old pig farm next door. They always use that excuse. I mean, they really hate pigs. But or they might have loud music, or they might have a bright light, or, you know, as you're well familiar with, they might have a red door for crying out loud.
Or they
house.
Put their cars up on blocks.
Yes, yeah, all these things. They paint these horrible pictures of what people might do with their property if they don't have any controls over them. But the fact of the matter is, since the beginning of human settlements, there has always been a recourse if somebody's doing something that actually hurts you.
Yes.
And, you know, the nuisance laws of some kind that you can file a lawsuit, you can do something against it, if something really is happening. But instead, we've created this atmosphere of a one-size-fits-all umbrella over everything with the precautionary principle that it might, kind of, maybe, sort of, could be. And so you end up with no property rights whatsoever and no ability to use your property because somebody on high has deemed that a no. We're not going to let you do that. And so what we see is the ability to use property to build wealth, the ability to build a middle class, the ability to be free on your own property is gone. And what is that called? I believe it's called socialism.
I think you might be right. I want to go back to the laws. Where you were talking about somebody comes up with the laws. You talked about putting up signs, and you talked about keeping people off your property. And you said if anything happened, then you know you always there always were other recourses, and there are laws, and you could go and get them. One of the big problems is that local municipal governments have shunted off their responsibility to such a point, to such an extent, where they refuse to enforce their own laws. They don't have the money, you see. They can't afford to send someone over to make sure that, you know, your toilet that's sitting in the front yard with some begonias blooming in it is, in fact, a detriment to the neighborhood. They can't be bothered. They just want their tax dollars, and they want you to leave them alone. And I think that's a big, huge problem right there. But going back to the sign, HOAs have these signs, these rules, these covenants, that you may not have a sign on your property. So everything is now in an HOA because these local municipal governments want them in an HOA so they can get this tax-free free tax dollars, property taxes, and not have to do anything. They don't want to enforce anything. They don't want to do anything. So the homeowner is sort of caught. They can't do anything without spending hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars and going to court with an attorney, maybe, who understands what the issues are, and quite often doesn't. But there are some serious problems there.
Yeah, absolutely. There are the threat of the intimidation, the threat of lawsuits. People are afraid to move forward. We'll just get along. I can see there are two sides to certain stories. If a homeowners association is a voluntary thing to join,
right,
and you join it and say, well, you know, I like this, and that's why I want to be part of that, and that's how I want to live, and everything. That's your choice. That's right. But when they make it so there are no other choices,
yes,
everything, every neighborhood has a homeowners association. Everything is ruled and regulated to the point that, you know, you can't do. You're all just a bunch of robots going in the same direction, doing exactly the same thing, and looking exactly the same way. Then that is not freedom. That is not private property ownership. You are just a cog in the wheel there, and you know, this is, but I agree that the communities want this because then the homeowners associations police the neighborhoods and they don't have to. And, you know, everybody just goes along to get along.
It's a $95 billion annual industry. Mm-hmm. This is a $95 billion. This is big money.
and a lot of people who get involved in that. I mean, I think everybody's got their story of the what you call the Homeowners Association Nazi, who goes around and, you know, with their white gloves on, inspecting everything you do in your neighborhood and turning you in and all that. People get on the boards and they suddenly have power they never had before. I'll be quite open and honest with you. My mother was her Homeowners Association Nazi. And we didn't disagree on very much politically, but that was the one we had knockdown, drag out arguments over. So I know about that.
I know you know, and you said that on the show too. But the thing is, Tom, all of these horror stories, they're nothing more than symptomatic of a much deeper issue.
Well, it is.
That's not the problem. I mean, that's not the problem.
Yeah.
The problem is a much bigger problem.
Well, and this is what we've been fighting all along. Just briefly, let me just mention, the whole issue of sustainable development and Agenda 21. When they brought that out, they said that Agenda 21 is a comprehensive blueprint for the reorganization of human society. And is that not what we're seeing? Private property disappears, free enterprise disappears, everything is top-down control, and people have absolutely no say in their lives. Now we're moving in a direction to perhaps get rid of create a cashless society. And we're moving to have a technology situation where you don't even drive a car anymore. It's going to drive itself and everything. Every one of these things is about control, to where your money is controlled. The greatest fear that these control freaks have is that you have money that they don't know about, that you could go and do something else. Paying cash, there's no record. There's no chip to follow you with that. But if you have to take it all out of your bank account in a cashless situation, using your credit cards, your debit cards, and so forth, then they know exactly where you are and what you're doing, what you're spending your money on. And so we're seeing this kind of creep come out about in every aspect of our lives, to where we have absolutely no individuality, no individual thought, no individual action, and it's all controlled by who? Who makes these rules, and by what right do they have to tell me how to think, how to do something, how to move, how to live? If I'm not hurting somebody else, if I'm not, as we go back to what we were talking about earlier with the nuisance laws and so forth, then so what? How does my red door diminish your property? How does, I understand if you got trash in your yard, I understand those kind of things, but, this is just control for control's sake, and it leads to a controlled society, to where we are all just pawns in the whole thing, and we have no right to say anything, we have no individuality, and let me back it up even a little bit more, Shu. If you take a look at what has happened since the election with Donald Trump, who has different ideas, you have children that have come up through the education system that are now horrified that somebody has a different idea than what they have had poured into their brains for 12 to 14 to 16 years. And they can't deal with it. They have to go to a safe spot and suck their thumb. Oh my goodness, he thinks something else. That is creating the citizens to live in this horrible technocracy that we're talking about. Where you just don't exist. You're just a cog in a wheel.
There's something that I find very horrifying that I've been watching, and that is the fact that our kids are not taught to respect anything or anyone. They are not taught to be dignified. That all seems to be such old-fashioned nonsense. But you know what? You see what you get when you don't respect your next-door neighbor, you don't respect somebody else. You have to have these rules. You have to have this hammer that comes down. You have to have these threats. You have to have these fines. They have to go after you, and people think that this is normal, and people believe that if you don't have all of this, then the world's going to come crashing to an end. And the fact is, it's not. If you and I had different ideas about something, we'll discuss them. I'll respect your ideas, you'll respect mine. Maybe you'll win an argument, maybe I'll win an argument. But at the end of the day, we'll still be friends.
Yeah. Don't you find it interesting that you and I grew up in a different country where, you know, we had that respect. People respected other people's property.
Yeah.
And they respected each other. They showed respect for each other. And now here we are when Big Brother is controlling everything and dictating everything, and we have this kind of education system that's, you know, creating those kind of pliable people. All of a sudden, we have what you just described. We don't have respect. We don't even have safety anymore. And you know, what has changed in that world that they're horrified by, where individuals made their own decisions and owned their own property and lived as they chose to live? People got along, but today they don't. You know, while the more they try to dictate to us, the more violent things become, the less respect there is. It's a very interesting paradigm.
There's a lack of manners, and if you don't think, if you're not part of this groupthink that seems to be going on, then the people in that group seem to think it's their duty and their honor, with vile language, foul behavior, to come in and force you, scream at you, force you to accept their point of view. And that,
you know,
I find scary.
I just wrote a new book called Erase, which is a
I need to get that. Yeah.
Thriller fiction. And the reason I bring that up is one of my main characters in the book is a teacher who is witnessing what is happening to the education system and how the children are changing and so forth. And as it goes along, they discover that there is a movement afoot behind the education, and the government's pushing is called globally acceptable truth. And a lot of people think I made that up for the book. I didn't. It actually exists, and as a policy, as a program. And the idea is that globally acceptable truth, in fact, the person who came up with this idea is the head of an organization called the Eden Foundation, which is out of the United Nations, and he advocates that the reason that we have war and strife and poverty, all this, is because there is too much knowledge, and that we need to, people are stressed out because they have to make decisions about their own lives. And so we create globally acceptable truth. Here are the things we all will believe, so you don't have to make those difficult decisions. We'll do it for you. And one of the things that I emphasize in the book is that their whole purpose is that the answer to every single question is government, and that everybody looks to government to answer, you know, any problems that they may have, and that becomes globally acceptable truth. This actually exists. It is actually something they're working to put in place.
I read an article years ago by Ayn Rand, who was a little concerned that if the Soviet Union collapsed, that you now had a generation of Soviets who had grown up in a society where they'd never made a single decision for themselves, not what to study, what school to go to, where to live, not even what to eat, because their meals depended on what they could get at the store. And the article I found absolutely fascinating because I started to thinking about it. So here you are, maybe in your 40s, and you're a parent, and you've got kids, and you're trying to raise them, and you've never in your entire life made a decision for yourself, made a choice for yourself. So that sort of weighed on my mind. Some years ago when I first started doing this show, I had an attorney who represented associations in Chicago who came on, and he told me that the biggest problem they had was with all the Russian immigrants in Chicago because they did not recognize the association's authority. So they just basically blew them off. So, you know, maybe it's a seesaw. Who knows? Maybe the kids who grew up under all this nonsense are going to say, screw it, we're not dealing with that. That's not...
Yeah. I've always said that the greatest mistake the West made when the wall came down and the Soviet Union collapsed was that we did not rush in there and take the opportunity to begin to teach them about freedom, about free enterprise, about private property, about individuality, and show them how it all works. We just let them flounder on their own. And there were many, many people in the Soviet Union and behind that Iron Curtain, just as you described, who had no idea what to do. And they went back to the government saying, please, please, give us some control here. Show us what to do. Show us the way. And so people like, the leaders that took over in the Soviet, well, now in Russia and a lot of those countries, ended up putting some of the same authoritarian dictatorships back in place because the people wanted it, because they were so afraid. It's a great, great failure on the side of the West.
Well, I think that part of the West actually went over. I believe that the community associations industry either did try to go over and teach them how to build condominiums and homeowner associations.
Goody.
Yeah. So that's what...
Rush right in there, you know.
Along with our bad food, we'll just keep sending this nonsense over. But I want to go back to your article. You have a list of things that you think Ben Carson should do, assuming, I'm going to guess, that he will eventually be approved and get to work. But you say that he should assure the complete protection of private property rights for every American. We know where we've lost it, so I know where that is. And immediately begin reining in the power of overreach and illegal policies of every federal agencies. You want to talk about that?
I think that has to begin with all of these agencies and pulling them in. I think they really are looking at the EPA as, you know, being able to do that, and some other agencies. But HUD is one of the worst offenders of massive overreach and intimidating, people that they are dealing with. So, yeah, that's number one, is to begin to look at the agencies and say we've got way too much government, way too much authority, way too much reach into people's lives, and the first thing that has to happen is that they have to be pulled back.
One of the other problems that we've talked about here, and I know you know exactly what I'm talking about, is the non-elected agencies like the PEC in Martha Bonetta's case, and I think small family farms are under a lot of stress. I've had a couple of farmers on who are going through the same nonsense that people in homeowners associations go through, but at the hands of local municipal governments and also non-governmental agencies, people who have not been elected. They just seem to creep out of the woodwork with all this power.
Yeah, well, again, it goes to the same thing of this kind of control, and I understand that Virginia has, I don't know if it's fully passed both houses yet or not, but at least one house has passed where the state government wants the power to go into every single farm and oversee everything on the farm and what they're doing and so forth. This is exactly what Martha Bonetta was fighting with the Piedmont Environmental Council was doing to her. So, and she got a lot of that overturned. Now they're coming right back with some of the same legislation again to just put it right back in place. But I know farmers, one of the big things that they try to do with conservation easements and selling of development rights and all that is to keep a farm. That's what they keep arguing. Well, I've never known a farmer who wanted to leave the farm. They wanted the farm. They're generations of farmers. But they have to sometimes because rules and regulations and taxes and on make it so they can't survive any longer. So the very reasons, you know, that they're trying to get out from under it is because of the same rules and regulations. So they come in and try to now make them prisoners on the farm by signing a conservation easement. They look at it as something with hope. Oh, this will help me keep it a farm. I've known so many farmers who didn't understand what the consequences of that were. And then they sign into it, and then they find out, I got more rulers than I ever had before. I can't do this. I can't do that. They're going to tell me how I can, what kind of products I can, I can grow on my farm. They're going to tell me how to do it. I can't survive with that. And now they're stuck in perpetuity to, forever to be stuck in this conservation easement. So this is, once again, another way where the government is taking control of the land and taking away the individuality and the liberty of the property owner.
I think one of the most important things is a farm, because without the food, we don't survive. And we've got so much bad food out there. And when you think
what we're seeing is these rules and regulations are made for one purpose. That is to build the power and the strength of corporate farming, which is a supplier of a lot of these things that we're talking about. And the individual farmer, the small farmer, can't compete and is put out of business. I'll tell you something, Shu. I was kind of made aware of something I hadn't really thought about before. I have a step-grandson who is now working for Outback Steakhouse. He's moving up into management. And he was just casually telling in the conversation how many different restaurant chains the corporation that owned the Outback he works for owns. And seven or eight different major chains that we deal with every day. And it suddenly became clear to me that we are moving in a direction to where one day we're going to have maybe 10 corporations in the world that operate everything. One corporation and all the banks. One corporation all the food sources. One corporation with a building, whatever that may be. And this is where we're headed in this way. And one of the big things that are being pushed in a lot of state governments right now are public-private partnerships. And a lot of conservatives are buying into this with the idea that bringing private industry in helps save money and gets the individuality and the creativity of business into government, and that's a really good thing. No, it isn't. A partnership between government and business is right out of the Mussolini fascist playlist. And when you start moving in that direction where all these corporations now are controlling all of what used to be free enterprise, it no longer exists, and they are in partnership with the government, what do you have there? You have no choice in all of that, and it's certainly not free enterprise.
Well, if you look at, for instance, the major shopping centers, the major chains like Macy's and all of these, they all belong to the same company, the same corporation, so there's no competition. You know, you might go into Nordstrom's, you might go into Bloomingdale's, you might go into Macy's. They're all in the same, they're all owned by the same people. You get off a plane in England, what's the first thing you see? TGIF, TGI Fridays, Starbucks. I don't get on a plane and go halfway around the world to run into the same restaurants that I leave behind here. I want something different. In fact, I had a friend come and stay, and we went out to lunch, and I'm trying to think, where can I take her that is not someplace she's going to have all over the country? You know, there are no surprises. There's nothing unique. There's nothing special. It's all part of a chain. It's all the same thing. It's like, you know, cookie cutter. Cookie cutter houses, cookie cutter restaurants, cookie cutter menus, bad food. You know, it's a disgrace.
We used to look at every state that, you know, the different states had different cultures, and we kind of reveled in that. And we would go and be interested. Maine had a different culture than Idaho, and, you know, it was kind of neat to go around all that. One of the things you might want to look up is a title, is a term called form-based code. This means is a means of regulating land development to achieve a specific urban form. And as you look through this, and I've got a report in front of me now, form-based code, and it's just that cookie-cutter thing you're talking about. Buildings look exactly alike.
Yeah.
Everything is organized exactly the same way. Every city will be exactly the same, with exactly all the same pieces and parts in it. And this is exactly where they're headed with this. And they call it a new response to the modern challenges of urban sprawl. You know, they create these horror stories, these enemies, these windmills to go after, and then they create all these programs to stop that, even if it doesn't exist. You know, urban sprawl. What is urban sprawl? This is people with homes that have a backyard, that have new development, that they you know, now you have shopping malls and stuff spring up. What's that do? It creates new jobs. It creates an economy. That's what it does. Smart growth that brings all this together into one big urban mess with high-rise buildings. What you're seeing now in these communities where they have done this is that when you put a line around the city and it can't grow outside of that, then you have this one small area of land, and the population does grow. The only way to grow is up, and now we're seeing that these high-rises, the apartments in them are starting to get smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
Pretty soon you're going to have one cot in a dormitory.
Yeah.
Where you're going to live, because they have put rules and regulations around these, and you have nowhere to go. And this is what they call a good thing. They keep promoting smart growth as like this 18th century atmosphere with all the modern conveniences in it, where people are able to just with their neighbors, that they're able to interact with them. You walk to work, you ride your bike to the grocery, you do this, you do that. How wonderful. No, it's not. And this is what we have to look at. It is destroying individuality. And you destroy individuality, you destroy progress, you destroy new ideas, you destroy you just destroy freedom, is what it's about.
Yeah, it's the new urbanism concept, and I've attended some of their presentations, if you will, and they will put up pictures of Paris, of London, and then they will put up pictures of cities in the States. And they will show you how much more pleasing Paris is than another city in the U.S. where it's not all infill. And they say, see this? You've got this whacking great big open hole here. There's nothing there. We need to turn it into what looks like Paris. Paris has taken hundreds and hundreds of years to develop. It wasn't done overnight. You don't come in with a bulldozer and build Paris. It's taken hundreds of years, and those buildings have lasted hundreds of years, as opposed to the garbage they're putting up now. And my listeners call me up because I've been saying everything's made of cardboard and scotch tape. And they're not meant to last. Fairfax County loves it. Because imagine a small footprint, and you can just pile on these luxury condos and charge all this money, and you don't have to do a damn thing for it. Because in a 250-square-foot apartment that you're talking about, you're not going to have kids, so your kids aren't going to go to school. You're not going to be doing anything. The other thing is they don't want you to have cars. So they limit parking, and they have these zip cars. So you rent it by the hour. If you need to go someplace, you rent a car by the hour. You don't have to worry about the maintenance. You don't have to worry about anything. You just rent it and put it back. And I don't know how long it's been since you've been here, but that's exactly what they've turned this area into. When I started this show, the Washington Post did an article on me, and they called it a seedy industrial area. It is now the Mosaic District, and it's exactly what you're talking about. Exactly.
Yeah, I've seen that, and it's just. And the other thing too, what happens when you create this kind of atmosphere as you're describing, is housing becomes more and more expensive.
Yes.
And so you have people who, you know, low-income people can't live there. And so and their neighborhoods, in many cases, are the ones that have been targeted, that are gotten rid of and bulldozed. And these high-rises, these expensive condos and so forth are created for wealthier people. So where do they go? And then we end up, and this is one of the things with HUD, is the Section 8 housing and federally subsidized housing. So now, and we said from the beginning, when you do that, when you create federally subsidized housing in certain areas, you basically are creating ghettos. You are creating places where you're shoving people together. And they are all dependent on the government. There's probably no jobs available to them there. They can't get the jobs. Nobody's building any jobs around them. We have a rust belt where our factories are not being built and are in disrepair and going, you know, overseas. And so there aren't any jobs available to them. So they have no ability to move up. They can't afford these expensive high rises and so forth. So now we have the Section 8 housing. We've created ghettos. We got crime. We got drug problems. We got all the things that go with that. Now we have the case, a classic case in Baltimore, where the NAACP sued the city of Baltimore, saying that Section 8 housing creates ghettos. And so the solution to that is to move the subsidized housing into the nicer upscale neighborhoods. That's going to make it better for everybody. What that's going to do is absolutely destroy the property values of the people who have worked their whole lives to build something there. It's going, of course, property rights are gone, and you've got people being moved into neighborhoods. I'm getting letters from people, low-income people, minority people, so forth, saying, can you help us? Our neighborhoods are being destroyed, and they're shoving us into places we don't want to be. Imagine how helpless that makes somebody feel who doesn't have wealth, doesn't have the income, and now they're put into places where people don't want them to be, and they don't want to be, and you put them in housing they can't afford, and, you know, it's not just about mortgage payments. It's not just about, well, we can subsidize so they can pay the mortgage. When you own a more expensive place, when you're living in it, you've got more expensive upkeep. And so, you know, they aren't able to keep it up. And it goes down here. There's not anything they can do about it. And, you know, so you've ended up ruining the property values of everybody around you. You've ruined their property rights. You've destroyed neighborhoods that people have worked to live there. This is the AFFH program, the Affirmatively Furthering Fair Housing program, that helped the NAACP file this idiotic lawsuit. Now Baltimore is having to pay $30 million of taxpayer money from there to build this kind of subsidized housing in upscale neighborhoods. And the other thing they did was they said that landlords cannot ask a potential tenant what their income is. That's racist. So now you know, what you're going to end up with is fewer landlords and fewer housing choices. It's just nuts all the way around.
I mean, that's how you qualify a tenant, is whether or not they're able to pay the rent. So if you don't ask them what they make, how does that make it racist?
Everything is racist. If it's against their policies, it's racist. And they use that. The reason they say that is because they have put all of this grandiose scale of stuff together, supposedly to help the poor. And when we, you know, horrible, mean, angry conservatives come in and say, you know, economically that's unsound, it won't work because of this, and their soundbite is, somebody has to do something, I got to care. That's what it's all about, caring. But they don't care. And it's, and we're telling you it doesn't work. Finally, after years of doing this, they come along and file a lawsuit saying exactly what we said. This doesn't work. This creates problems. But their answer is, let's take that problem and spread it to the nicer neighborhoods. Yeah, so everybody is equally poor. That's brilliance of what they're doing.
It's, you have it and I don't and I want it. And that's basically it. No common sense at all. But that goes also, ties hand in hand with something that I have a real hard time with, and that's where we're building HOAs and putting poor people in there who would never be able to buy their own home. And yet we have an HOA. They're not able to manage their finances. They're not able to put it aside. They don't have the business acumen to be able to fund a house and take care of all of that problem. But now all of a sudden we've put them in charge of maintaining a homeowners association, coming up with money to maintain the infrastructure, to, you know, it's just, Tom, we've lost every ounce of common sense we may have had at some point. We no longer have it.
That's the political correctness we're talking about. You're not allowed to say this, you can't say that, and I'm going to go suck my thumb if you do. And, you know, but again, let's go back to the very beginning, what we were talking about, the education system. If we had an education system that focused on academics, that focused on economics, that focused on philosophy, that focused on ideas where people could understand the consequences of actions, so forth, then we would have well-rounded people who could then go out and make their own decisions. Instead, we've turned them into job training programs. We've turned them into behavior modification systems with psychology as more important than academics. And we end up with global village idiots. And that is what we're seeing happen here.
So what we're going to end up with is a bunch of toothpicks, a pile of toothpicks, because, we're just building this garbage for the sake of it. We're swaying in the wind, basically, because we don't want to be called racist. We're just doing so incredibly stupid things, such incredibly stupid things, that somebody's going to have to pay for it at some point.
Yeah.
Whether you and I are still around when the stuff hits the fan or not, I don't know.
Yeah. Let's just say it. There is not a shortage of property. There is not a shortage of resources. We have man-created shortages of these things because we have rules and regulations that are banning it. And so what we end up with are shortages of housing. We end up with more poor. It's what, you know, we have what I call the compassion cartel. We have both government and private organizations that are all about helping the poor. But we've spent billions and billions of dollars for that purpose. But yet, what do we have because of all that? More poor. It's a growth industry. And all of these programs just create more. If you're really interested in helping them, if you're really interested in eliminating the division of races and that kind of hatred and all that kind of stuff, then get government out of the way. And let people do on their own what they do. One of the things that have happened in Portland, Oregon, which is the poster child for all of this kind of stuff, the smart growth stuff, is supposed to eliminate sprawl, eliminate traffic jams, make things more affordable, make things fairer. Well, they have more congestion, they have more sprawl, they have more crowding, they have fewer housing choices, and now Portland has just okayed a construction tax that they need to pay for more affordable housing. So that means every building built now has a tax on it, and every house, so forth. So housing costs are going to go up. You know, again, it doesn't work. Get out of the way.
Brilliant. Tom, thank you so much. We are out of time. I always love having you, and I hope you'll come back really soon.
Absolutely, anytime.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.